Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick try to act as the net control for the technical net. The technical net meets most Sunday evenings, starting at 8 o'clock until until the wee hours of the morning. And you'll see, what you'll mostly hear are amateur radio operators very interested in their hobby, teaching each other. This is a school. There's an awful lot to be learned about wireless equipment, antennas and transmission lines, and receivers and transmitters and propagation, and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area of New Jersey, over southern New York State, Long Island, and Connecticut. And we try to tap into that. You'll hear guys hearing their particular subject where they've got some experience. They'll give us the benefit of their experience as someone asks a question. Almost all of the subjects discussed on the TechNet are the subjects that you bring. We occasionally have a planned subject, but most of the time we do not. So it's the subject that you guys ask. We try very hard to answer everyone's question through signs in at the beginning, within the first hour. In other words, in theory, you shouldn't have to wait for more than an hour to get at least a partial answer. By 9 o'clock, we try to answer all the questions of those who sign in the beginning. Those who sign in later, maybe not. And there was one person last week, for instance, who signed in, and we didn't get a chance to get to him before he got called away. And so if he shows up this week, he goes number one on the runway. At 9 o'clock, Mel will go to his mailbag because there are people who are getting the ham radio license, and they send him emails and snail mails, and we try to answer those questions. After that, Paul, WS2N, will be telling us what has happened in space. And the Upper Atmosphere Research satellite, as you know, came crashing to Earth. 5 tons of material came crashing to Earth, so we're going to be hearing a little bit about that. There was a flea market today, a hammer at the Levittown Hall. And for those who attended, we'd like to hear what you liked, what you didn't like, were there enough vendors, were there enough buyers, were there enough people, did you meet your friends, did Andy, the B2CDL, get a chance to tune up your rig? Tell us what was the Ham Expo, the Hammerammer, the flea market, call it what you like, the get-together that took place at Levittown Hall today. Give us your words on that. Let me drop. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in might sound like this, N2APG, Dave, and yes. So give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RYW listening.
W-H-R-Y-Y. Joe. Yes.
Okay, well done. We got Joe. Who else? Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2ZLI, Frank, and no.
I presume that was Zebra Lima, India, Frank. Okay, and Frank with a no. Anyone else? Give me your call letters. K2RIW.
N2DET, no questions.
Okay, maybe we'll have people signing in a little bit later. Joe, looks like we're going to have a light night tonight, so you got lots of time. W-H-R-Y-Y, how are things going in your neighborhood? K-2-R-Y-W in the TechNet.
W-H-R-Y-Y, very good, Dick. And if you can guess the question before I ask it, I'll give you dinner for two, free. Let's see. Matt, you want to take a crack at that? Might be lucky.
Quite often you're involved in television, digital television DXing. Let's see, last week, I'm looking at last week's check-in by Joe, and I didn't write down the subject. Base launch system. Now that was somebody else.
MOVs.
What was that again, John?
MOVs, protection circuits.
Well done. Good memory. Yes. So you wanted to know something about how many cycles, how much energy they could absorb, what's the best way of getting real protection. You also worried about the, it's coming back to me now, you were proposing to put a zener diode across a tantalum capacitor in order to protect it. And you asked the question that way two or three times, and each time Glenn, KC2QIQ, was telling you no, that most likely wouldn't work, because as a tantalum capacitor ages, and there's various things that accelerate its aging, its maximum voltage, no matter what it started off at, decreases. So you could start off with a capacitor at 18 volts, and it might eventually end up as only being a 9-volt capacitor 10 years later because of the way it's being abused. And if it's in a 12-volt circuit, no way in the world is any kind of a zener diode going to protect in that case. And the zener diode also, I'm recalling all this information because last week we had a very unusual technet. And that we learned an awful lot of the dark side of capacitors and their voltage ratings, particularly electrolytic-like capacitors. So their decreasing voltage rating is one thing to worry about. Various people would speculate that an instantaneous exceeding of the voltage, the working voltage, would create the problem. And the answer probably is not, because the real problem is a thermal problem. If you're doing something for a long enough period of time to create excess heating inside the tantalum capacitor, that's where the damage takes place. And so a capacitor rated for 18 volts and for a fraction of a second you put 24 volts on it, most likely that's not going to do it. So those are some of the things we learned last week, and wonder what else you found out along those lines or whatever else you'd like to talk about this week. You got the floor, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Vic. This ought to be a good one. It's really more or less a curiosity question more than anything else, and it has to do with crystals. I had a mobile to air radio, which I pulled the crystal out of the second locality because it was defective, and I put another one in, replaced the crystal, and got the radio back working again. Okay, that's not really the question. The curiosity part of the question, the question really is, it's a curiosity thing. I decided to see what the crystal would do when it had a RF excitation applied across it, looking at it with a tracking generator on a spectrum analyzer. And I always thought that crystals could be used as oscillator circuits, or they could be used as filtering circuits where they pass signals. In this particular case, the crystal is defective because it didn't work in the circuit anymore, but applying RF excitation across it, like one lead going from the tracking generator, the other side going to the spectrum analyzer port of my analyzer, and what I noticed that the frequency of the crystal that was stamped on the can was an extremely sharp null. And I not only saw a null there, it happened to be at 44.645, I saw another null appear at 44.715. I wonder if you could just simply explain what I was possibly looking at here and what phenomena might have been going on here. Crystal didn't work in the circuit as an oscillator, but yet it seemed to be working as a shunt, where it was or an extremely tight notch filter. Back to you.
There are various ways of constructing the crystal, X-cut, AT-cut, whatever. In other words, the crystal itself has a kind of a grain structure to it, and depending on what plane in the XYZ axis you do the cut, you get various characteristics as far as frequency of resonance versus temperature. Also, do you favor the series mode, the parallel mode, or the harmonic mode? So there's lots and lots of ways of cutting and using and mounting crystals. Most crystals have at their fundamental frequency a combination of series and parallel resonance. One is slightly higher than the other. In other words, if you swept very, very slowly with, let's say, a network analyzer across the crystal, you would find at the parallel resonant frequency, it becomes nearly an open circuit, and an extremely small frequency nearby, difference frequency nearby, it'll have a series mode where it becomes almost a short circuit. So it's almost a short circuit at the series resonant mode, and it's almost an open circuit at the parallel resonant mode. And those two frequencies are very, very close. It's not more, in other words, the exact schematic diagram is that You have an inductor in series with a capacitor, and the inductor is huge, like it's Henry's, and the capacitance is fractions of a picofarad. That's a series resonance. Across it is also a stray capacitance because of the mounting structure and the pins that come out of the case and whatever. So it's a series structure shunted by a parallel capacitor. That's one of the simplified schematic diagrams, and it gives you partial explanation for why has both a series and a parallel resonance mode. The series mode, when you go higher in frequency than you're supposed to, than the series resonance.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm waiting long enough to make sure that if anyone out of area wants to sign in, they have enough time to do it. So periodically, I'm going to wait beyond the four beeps. So if anyone wants to sign in, hopefully they get the opportunity. When you go higher in frequency than the series resonant mode is where that multi-Henry inductor and a couple of fractions of a picofarad capacitor, they're at resonance where the inductor reactance equals the capacitor reactance. You go slightly higher in frequency. The inductor reactance increases, the capacitor reactance decreases. You're left over, you're left over with some inductive reactance. Therefore, the parallel capacitance will now re-resonate with that and create an open circuit. So the parallel resonant mode, if my schematic diagram and my mental image is correct, the parallel resonant mode is very slightly higher in frequency than the series resonant mode. Most crystals have both. And depending on how you use it, there's certain kinds of oscillators that use the parallel mode and certain kinds of oscillators that use the series mode. I think the series mode is the one most often used. And what you saw as a suckout was the parallel resonant mode. Very, very slightly lower than that, I think you would find a mode where all of the signal gets coupled through, the so-called series resonant mode. Maybe that helps a little bit. Drag your feet in case we have other people who have got more smarts than I do on crystal oscillator, the actual quartz crystal, and give us the call letters so that we can hear what they know. W-H-U-R-Y-Y to... And as you guys know, Mel, K2KEY, he's one of many guys who have put together a whole bunch of crystals into a structure called a crystal lattice filter. 2, 3, 4 crystals used just right can make an extremely sharp, high-performance bandpass filter network. N2EO, K2RIW. Let's find out what the guys in Whitestone know about this. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Vic, just a footnote. You know, you can take a grid-dip meter. I have an ICO grid-dip meter that I purchased on eBay used. Very good condition. You can take a little one-parent loop, put it across the pins of the crystal, couple it to a grid-dip meter, and you'll see a dip in the frequency if the crystal is good. Just wanted to add that thing.
Yeah, when you put a coil across a crystal and then grid dip it, to my knowledge, you're using the parallel resonant mode. Yeah, you're using the parallel resonant mode. Let's think now. The coil that you're putting has got some inductance. Crystal to resonate with that would have to be a series capacitance. The series capacitance is going to take place a little bit lower, very slightly lower than the normal series resonant frequency. So. That technique for measuring, this particular microphone, I like the sound of it a little bit better. So that's another very good way of measuring crystal resonance. My guess is if you Google the word crystal oscillator test circuit, or if you look at the right issue of QST magazine or the amateur radio handbook, you will probably find recommended circuits for measuring a crystal to find out its exact oscillating frequency, the output of the network you can put into a frequency counter, and therefore you know exactly what crystal, what frequency the thing is on. So there are recommended circuits for doing the testing. And there's probably even a circuit where you flip a switch and it'll first measure the series mode, and then to flip the switch it'll measure the parallel mode. I wonder if you've ever seen any circuits like that. Over to you first, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
K2KEY would have comment.
WGB would have comment.
Okay, we got Rich, Mel, and John in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Dick, yeah, I've seen crystal oscillator test circuits. I've never built one, but it's something to think about. One of these, you know, I do a lot of the vintage work, a lot of the radios, the vintage radios. When the crystals get very, very old, like I have a KWM-1 from about 1958, the crystals tend to move more frequency. And I've replaced some of them with new crystals from the International Crystal. Also in the 62S-1, I had to do that. But, I really have not built one of those circuits, but over the years I've seen various test circuits. Back to that.
When you say it moved off frequency, give me a hint as to how far it moved. Is it 2 kilohertz out of the 7 meg band, or was it 20 kilohertz? How far did it move, if you remember, Rich? Go ahead.
I've seen it move as much as... In the HFO, the high-frequency oscillator, you know, normally you would go band to band and set the calibrate points to the nearest 100 kc point. I've seen it vary 3-4 kc from band to band. And it gets to be a nuisance. And the KWM-1, which covers 80, 40, and 20 meters, does not cover 10 and 15 on, I think it's 20 meters. It's off about 6 or 7 kc. Eventually, I'm going to have new crystals made by International Crystal, because on the Collins, there's no warping capacitor to bring them in. And I don't want to modify the circuitry, you know, because these are vintage radios. Okay, Dick?
Very fine, Rich. Good information. Mel's next. Not only did you select a zillion crystals and married a set of them into your crystal lattice filter, but I bet you you've studied an awful lot of the crystals on your Collins equipment. K2KEY, K2RAW, go ahead, Mel.
Hey, good evening, all. Vic, I meant to comment about the email that you sent me. That was a shocker. Really, okay. As far as crystals, if you remember, yeah, a few years ago I was involved with making those lattice filters for my own designs, and, you know, to put in the right number of different sections to the filter design. And what you were saying really about the voice of the crystals, just this frequency. So in order for me to go through all those crystals, and I went through literally, now I'm not going to exactly hundreds of crystals that were purchased extremely cheap. They were selling these crystals that were used in the TV, VCR, and construction, and a lot of those crystals being sold off literally for pennies each. But the point is, you have to know a lot more about the crystal, like I say, than its frequency. For most cases, the frequency that was printed on it was enough for its use in any of that equipment. So in order to go ahead and determine a lot of things about the crystal, especially cubes, things of that sort, Communications Quarterly, if you look at, have to Google back, Communications Quarterly did a whole thing strictly on building a test instrument to determine everything about a crystal that you ever wanted to know if you were determined to build your own filter stick. Go ahead.
Very good. The Communications Quarterly crystal testing circuit. Make me a rough guess, Mel. Was it 1 year ago or 5 years ago that the article on crystal testing was there? Over to you, Mel.
My best estimate is more than 10 years ago. It was at least minimum of 10 years ago. Back in the 90s, definitely. I believe late 90s. And it's a little bit of going. If you're going to get seriously into the crystal, doing anything with crystals, is well worth the effort, because, boy, oh boy, you'll find out things. You'll look at these crystals, and everything from, they have the tap test, in other words, you put it in, you give them a little tap, and see what happens, and you've got other kinds of tests, and you'll be amazed that a lot of those crystals, you would say, for normal use, in the thing that it was meant to run, in that type. And who knows, maybe these crystals were even rejects. Many of them, you know, pigtail crystals, sealed little cans. Maybe the manufacturers, maybe these were even rejected because a lot of them were never even soldered, Dick. Over.
So the tapping of the crystal is finding out whether or not it's microphonic. One of the quality factors you measure of a crystal is Q. If you've got really precise equipment, you can measure the upper and lower 3 dB roll-off frequency and divide that difference in frequency into the central frequency, and that's one of the definitions of Q. Another definition of Q is what is the equivalent series resistance that's left over when you hit series resonance. In theory, if the crystal was perfect, when you hit series resonance, the amount of resistance left over at that resonant frequency would be nearly zero ohms. My guess is some of your better crystals that you were measuring probably had numbers like, I'm going to pick a number, like 10 ohms of equivalent series resistance. What kind of series resistances were you encountering at what central frequency of crystals that you were testing? How back to you, Mel.
Crystals, those are the type of crystals, like you say, when you're buying a penny each. Those were the crystals that you found that were very prevalent. Yeah, 3.58 crystals, the color subcarry crystals. There were 4.5 crystals. 8, a lot of 8 megahertz crystals. Some of them even back to the old cycle. Well, I even had 8 megahertz that were crystals made by a company called Bailey, B-I-L-E-Y, Bailey Crystal Company. And those days, they put the crystals together with a little case with a plug-in, a little case with screws. Four little screws in the front of the panel that came off the inside. This crystal was held in there with two contacts and a spring. So they were very prevalent, those types of crystals. Like I say, 3.58, 4.5, 8 megahertz crystals. Let me think what else was there. Oh, hard to remember, but gee, there was, like I say, they were just tons on the market. And that's what I was dealing with. So I adapted everything to what I was available, Dick, over.
Yes, in the old days, I think the crystal holder, the one with the four screws, is called an FT243, if I remember correctly. Mel's going to correct me on that in a few minutes. He had four screws in the four corners of this rectangular package, which was about an inch and a quarter high and a little bit less than an inch wide and about half an inch thick. It was a piece of Bakelite. You loosened the four screws. You were removing the metal cover on the front. Underneath that metal cover was a spring. The spring was pressing on two rather large metal plates that were inside. The metal plates had four raised corners in each one of the four corners of these metal plates, and in between those two metal plates and those raised corners is where the slab of quartz existed. And so a really smart amateur in the early days when Mel and I were cutting our teeth in the late 40s, early 50s, you could literally take that slab of quartz out, put it on two large surfaces where you have just the right kind of grinding compound, and by very gently grinding that crystal, you could move it up in frequency. You could also take the quartz crystal out and rub pencil lead on it, which added a little bit of extra mass to the crystal, and move it down in frequency a little bit. Had two great big pins coming out of the bottom. So I think it was called FT243, and I wonder if you've ever done any of those crystal grinding operations, Mel, in your early days. I didn't, but I talked to the people who did. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I did it in the 60s, Dick, at 2 a.m.
We're going to come back to you in a minute. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Actually, the poor man's Nobbins VFO, if you remember, you took one of those FT243 crystals. You took the front, that little cover off the stick you just mentioned. Now, you took that had a spring behind it. Now, you take that out, you took that out, and what you do with the cover plate, you tapped it for a 632 screw. Now, what happened is, the 632 screw on the other side of the 632 screw was that little plate. You soldered the plate back onto the other end of the screw. And if you were clever enough, you could get a little knob to put on that. Now you put the thing back together. So now by loosening and tightening that screw plate against the crystal, you can shift the frequency, Dick, over.
Fantastic. See, in the early days when you had a novice license, where you were allowed to operate in 3.75 to 3.8, I think it was. Anyhow, you had about 25 or 50 kc of the 80 meter band, a little bit of the 40 meter band, a little bit of the 21 megacycle band, and you had to be crystal controlled. However, a poor man's VFO, variable frequency oscillator, was what Mel was talking about, this screw that would change the pressure on the plates that were holding down the piece of quartz. Make me a rough guess, Mel, on which band, 80 meters or 40 meters, did you do that, and roughly how far could you VFO a quartz crystal by turning that 632 screw? Could you move it 5 kilohertz? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Boy, you got me now. Dick, you're going to have to take me back, you know, 50-plus years. Well, I haven't talked. Let me say you'd be back. To talk about 1953, 54, when I was a novice. I know it varied a few kilohertz. Yeah, and the only band I had, Dick, as a novice, I only had one. I only had a receiver for 80 meters. That was the ARC 5 receiver. And that homebrew little rig that I built, that 6L6. And that crystal system I had, you know, finding, going through the barrels of crystals in New York City on Cortlandt Street and trying to find something that fit into the 80-meter novice band, like you say, at that 3.7.00 to 3.50, you know. That was the novice band. You had that 50 kilohertz, you know, of the novice band of on 80 meters, and that was it. On 80 meters, so that's all I had, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm not absolutely positive on this, but I think the novice band in those days was 3,700 to 3,750. I think that was our novice band. You had to be crystal controlled, so everybody's squeezing in that little 50 kilohertz. And quite often, the two crystals you own, each one of them would be on top of somebody else's frequency, and you'd be getting QR Mary. And so by having a little bit of swishing capability, a couple of kilohertz, by squeezing the crystal and relaxing it and so on, you could move it off to that to some wide open spaces, so to speak, where some people would be more likely to give you an answer to your CQ. And the very first novice CW contact I had on 80 meters, of course, it's very nervous. I talked to a guy in Amityville when I'm living in Farmingdale, one town away, and I remember I was sweating like crazy while trying to copy this Morse code and trying to remember. I gave him my name, my location, and whatever, and he said, RST question mark, and I went on and gave him some more conversation. He came back and said, RST question mark, and he did that about 5 times in a row. I wasn't smart enough yet to know that RST stood for readability, signal strength, tone, and he was asking for a signal report, and I didn't yet know what that meant. Because me and a buddy of mine named Robert, I'm K2RIW, he was K2RJB, and Robert and we practiced with a Morse code oscillator, taught each other ham radio. No other real Elmer was helping us, so the hidden information was, you know, what did RST mean? I eventually found out, as you can tell. All right, we've got Glenn and Rich in that order with some further information about crystals. KC2QIQ, I bet you worked with some crystals in your day, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, that was me, Dick, I believe.
Okay. Boy, am I mixed up. You got it, John.
Good evening, Dick, Mel, everyone in the net. Dick, I just wanted to mention, when years ago when we were working in the lab, we would find that, which will relate to what Joe was saying, we would find that a crystal on its fundamental frequency would start to reduce its activity. It would work fine at its fundamental, but if it was used in an overtone, it seemed that the overtone would fall off at a much faster rate than the fundamental. So if it would work there, but not at overtone, we found that quite a few times. I don't know if you've ever wondered that.
Hey, you're on to something here, John. What's your best guess as to what was happening as the crystal would age? Are you guessing that it absorbs some moisture from the environment, that it had been exposed to some kind of chemistry that slowly ate its way into the crystal and changed its characteristics? Maybe the contacts on the crystal holder started developing extra resistance. Got a guess as to what was creating the grief where the crystals showed less activity on the harmonic frequencies. And then I guess you went and bought another one and the problem went away. But did anybody do a post-mortem on the bed one to find out what happened? KC2WGB, K2LAW, you got it, John.
Yes, Dick, when we found this problem, there were so many of them that we actually sent it back to the QC guys, and they told us, they came back about 2 weeks later and said there were minute fractures developing in the quartz itself. It wasn't affecting the frequency, but it was affecting the active amount of output that crystal would have.
Okay, now, what's really going on here, let me give you guys a couple of words that were beyond what Joe was asking, and that is, why do we use a quartz crystal? Why don't we just use an inductor and a capacitor to set the frequency? You build yourself a good inductor, a good capacitor across it. You've got a resonant frequency. You line it up with your grid dip meter, with your network analyzer, your spectrum analyzer, and your signal generator, whatever. And to build a resonator where the Q is more than, let's say, 500 or 1,000 is very difficult. A Q of 1,000 would mean that if the crystal was resonating at 1 megacycle, and I divide 1 megacycle by 1,000, I get 1 kilohertz. The crystal would be approximately 1 kilohertz wide if it was a crystal running at 1 megacycle, if it had a Q of 1,000. Gives you a little bit of an idea what Q is. A really good quartz crystal in a vacuum environment properly mounted can approach a Q of 1,000,000. That means when you build an oscillator out of that crystal, where it's resonating at 1 megahertz, it'll have a bandwidth of 1 hertz. Not 1 kilohertz, 1 hertz. 1 hertz of bandwidth. So when it comes to really defining your frequency and getting an extremely sharp filter, an extremely high Q circuit, you almost cannot beat a quartz crystal being properly used. Now you know why they're used. They really determine the frequency with extreme accuracy if it's properly used and properly mounted and so on. The next thing you've got to worry about, though, is the way the piezoelectric works. Let me drop. I've heard it pronounced piezoelectric, piezoelectric, but the piezoelectric effect is such that when you put voltage on it, the crystal bends in some way. It either bends like an oil can, or it flexes, it twists. It bends in some way mechanically. The mechanical resonance is what really is determining the resonant frequency. If you set it up into an oscillator where the total power going through the crystal is too great, that means the total amount of mechanical deflection you're subjecting the crystal to will create extra heating, thermal effects, and eventually mechanical failure by fracture. So, do you believe, John, that there is a possibility that the total power going through the crystal was a little bit excessive compared to what the manufacturer recommended, and was that possibly the aggravating factor that was giving you this grief? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I believe you're right, Dick. I believe the mechanical structure of that crystal that was designed for these units was not strong enough to hold the crystal while it was doing its thing. So what they wound up doing is change the amount of energy that was tickling the crystal, because otherwise we would have had a long wait for new parts that would have had to be made. And by changing that, we never had any more crystal failures. So I believe that's exactly what was happening. And by the way, I have a question when you finished. I didn't check in with a question, but I just thought of one now.
Glad to hear that, Sean. Let me drop for long enough for somebody to check in if they want to. Wesley recognized. You'll be after Rich. Do you remember, John, how much current or milliwatts or watts or whatever was apparently being applied to the crystal when you were getting the grief? And then when you cut it back to a lower amount of power, how did you rate that? Was it crystal current or crystal voltage? Or milliwatts of applied power? Do you happen to know the units before and after that were creating the grief? And roughly what frequency was that crystal on? You got it, John. KQLAW.
Dirk was operating at about 10 megahertz, and the voltage, the active voltage, was brought down. And I believe the total dissipation across the crystal was only like 1.5 milliwatts. So it was damaging the crystal. And from what I believe, if I remember correctly, they went down to approximately 1 milliwatt, and we never had any more problems.
Now, 1 milliwatt of mechanical resonance, it sounds like sleep power, but you'd be amazed what that really means. As we were discussing last week, 1 milliwatt of true acoustic power being applied to the ear canal of a human being is right at the threshold of pain. You're right at the threshold where you can create ear hearing damage. And some of the popular devices like an iPod 5G has 30 milliwatts per channel, two channels, and if those particular ear pods you're using happen to have more than 3% efficiency, the 30 milliwatts would be more than a milliwatt of audio, and as such, in theory, they can create hearing damage if you turn them up full blast. So lots of people are doing all kinds of things to their hearing. So a milliwatt of mechanical energy, whether it be acoustic energy into the hearing canal, or whether it be a mechanical resonance of a crystal, is a significant amount of energy. It's hard to believe. I wonder if you've run into some of these things of crystal aging and crystal repair and loss of activities and tuning them to various frequencies. Give us a few words on how you've used crystals over the years, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, Big N2EO. Well, I'm familiar with what Mel mentioned. The 632 screw, that was in the AWRL handbook back in the 1960s. And what I had done, I got my license when I was 15 years old in 1965. I was on 6 meter AM. The Heath Kit Shawnee that I put together, an HW10 Shawnee, and that had a PFO, but it also had crystal, four crystal positions. And I had a crystal for right around 50.1, which is right on the edge of the CW segment of the band, and I wanted to move it up. So I had read an article in the old 73 magazine on grinding crystals. They told you, put it on a piece of glass, I used Benami. You want to use some sort of a gritty substance. I used my mother's Benami as a, what do you call, is a grinding compound, and they told you go in a figure eight pattern, and I didn't have a piece of glass, but I used the bathroom mirror. Didn't ruin the mirror, but it did grind the crystal. I was able to move it up above 50.1 by taking the port, like you said, take the screws out of the FT243 holder, take the crystal blank out. I made a paste out of the a grinding compound, and it took about a half hour going in a figure eight, and I moved it up. I don't know how far I actually moved the crystal, but it would have been multiplied because they were 8-bit megacycle crystals multiplied up to 6 meters. So I guess it's six times whatever you move it, it's going to move six times due to the multiplication factor. Again, they get to the up.
Yeah, 8 megacycle crystals in the early days were very popular for getting on 6 meters, 2 meters, and 432, choosing the right crystal with the right harmonic, and you were there. And they do a very good job of determining the crystal. When you did that grinding with the cleaning compound called Bonami, which I guess is the equivalent of Babo, and I can't remember some of these other things, in other words, there's real grinding compound inside of these cleaners, as well as other kinds of soaps. Was there any change in the crystal activity? Was it equally as responsive when you moved it up after that grinding process? And my guess is you had to do a careful cleaning and drying job before putting it back together in order to make it oscillate correctly. My guess is while it was wet, it either wouldn't oscillate at all because water is lossy, or it would be on too low a frequency because of the mass of the water. I wonder what you experienced along those lines, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Well, I was a kid, you know. I remember, I had to dry it off, keep it clean, put it back in the holder, and If it wasn't up far enough, I popped it out of the holder, went back to the mirror, ground it a little more, brought it up a little more, dried it off, went back and forth. Spent like maybe a few hours doing a thing like that. There was a number of times with 8 megacycle crystals, 6 meters, and it worked. If you ground them too far, they'd stop oscillating. But I had very good luck with that thing.
What did you use as the other surface to press against the bathroom mirror? What was the other smooth surface that was doing the grinding, go ahead?
Something very sophisticated, my hand. I held it blank in my hand and ran it around on the mirror in a figure eight pattern, turned it over to the other side, and it would take maybe about a half hour to move it up.
How about that? Yeah, I think you were supposed to put it between a pair of very flat surfaces in order to maintain the parallelism between the plates. And if you disturb that parallelism, I think you lose activity. Wesley, N2EO, go ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hendricks, yeah. Two things. We're talking about the failures in the crystals. Well, there's certain incoherent failure mechanisms that I have found in the crystals. Some are operating in devices for decades, and failure may, however, be by introduced fault in bonding or leaky exposures, corrosion, frequency shift by aging. So the breaking the crystal by too high mechanical shock or radiation-induced damage when Northwest quartz is being used. And the crystal could also be damaged by overdriving. And in particular, I was testing the 4 megahertz crystal. Didn't take much to break up. So that's one of the things that I would like to mention. But I don't know if you guys remember, definitely into your does, a Collins 455 kilohertz mechanical filter. Has nothing to do with the crystal. It's a mechanical filter. And additional factor to discuss is a ceramic filters. So back to the net and to Asia.
KC2YDT, late check-in. Please add me to the list, sir.
We got you, Matt. YDT, KC2YDT. Many materials are piezoelectric. It turns out that all of the disc ceramic capacitors that you use for bypass capacitors, if you've got an extremely sensitive audio circuit where you're using those capacitors, you'll find out that they are microphonic. In other words, somebody makes a sound in the room or taps on the circuit, and your disc ceramic bypass capacitor generates a couple of microvolts of a voltage that gets induced into the circuit and will eventually come out of the loudspeaker. So many ceramic capacitors, many porcelain materials, many quartz-like materials, quite a few materials have piezoelectric or piezoelectric characteristics. Mechanical shock, mechanical deflection creates voltage, or vice versa, voltage will create a mechanical deflection. And so Collins, I think, was one of the main manufacturers of some extremely high-quality bandpass crystal filters. Let me drop. They were called Collins mechanical filters. Some of them were on 455 KC, some of them were on 8 megacycles. Many of the Collins single sideband filters are mechanical filters. So by taking a slab of material and cutting it into slots so that it looks like a comb-like structure, and by having just the right spacing between those individual slabs, and just the right loading between them and whatever, you've got this comb-like structure, and you induce a voltage at one end, and what comes out of the other end is extremely well filtered. So you can build, I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me that some of those Collins mechanical filters had the equivalency of 10 poles inside, 10 LC equivalent circuits, with just the right coupling coefficients and just the right center frequency, see, so that you get this extremely sharp, well-tuned filter. I think you got to be a little bit careful with one of these things. If you dropped it on the floor, I think there's a good chance you're going to create damage and lose its characteristics. But I'll bet many of you guys have used Collins mechanical filters and fell in love with them and probably are pretty unhappy about the fact that there may not be a manufacturer for those these days. Give us some words if you happen to know about Collins mechanical filters. Give us some words on that right now. Give us your call letters. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? Okay, give us the rundown on Collins mechanical filters. What center frequency? How good? How expensive? Are they still manufactured? What do you got to do to get a hold of them to update your Collins equipment? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, they're still available, not from Collins. I forget the name of the company now, but it escapes me. But, you know, I have a 7584 Collins receiver that I fully restored, and that had three positions for filters. And what do I have in there? I've got a 6KC, I've got a 2.1, and I've got a 500 cycle CW filter. There is a company making remake of the Collins filters for the 7584. They're about $100 a piece. My KWM2, of course, has the original Collins filter in it, 455 kHz center frequency. And I'll tell you, Vic, that they're very, very sharp in the sense that they've got very, very steep skirts. You put a 500 cycle Collins filter into a receiver, It feels a lot tighter than a 500 cycle filter on some Japanese radio because the skirts are a lot sharper. In other words, if you put it off the side, it drops off a lot faster. The skirts are a lot steeper. There's still excellent filters today. And the mechanical filter, maybe Mel can add something to this. I don't think it's actually a quartz. It's a ceramic filter. Let me turn it back to you, Dick. Turn it over to Mel. He can probably fill you in. Round ceramic resonators in there. Back to you, Dick.
Coming.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be quartz. It just has to be a piezoelectric responsive material. We're going to go over to Wesley and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, talking about the mechanical filters, the mechanical elements, all of the filters has to obey the mathematical function, which is the identical to their corresponding electrical elements. So this makes it possible to apply electrical network analysis to the filter design method to the mechanical filters. Yeah, but in mechanical filters, a signal processing system usually used is in place of the electronic filter radio frequency. So it's the basics of that. But I recall the company that was at the same time called Collins was called Hokusai. Although they were not very widely known, they have made a quality of filters even better, if not at the same quality as Collins. Kokusai, K-O-K-U-S-A-I, electric company. And they had, been having a 2 kilohertz narrow bandwidth signals for the single sideband receiver. And they were operating at 455 kilohertz of common IF. I don't know if you recall that, Dick.
Now, Kokusai is a brand new brand name to me, and so I think you're saying they had at least the same quality as those Collins mechanical filters. There are people who really fell in love with those filters because the basic resonator, the piezoelectric material inside of the mechanical filter, was the equivalent of using an extremely high-quality inductor-capacitor pair for each one of the poles, and each one of those slices acted like a pole of the filter and coupled the energy from the adjacent pole into the next resonator, so to speak, with just the right band pass and just the right coupling characteristic. The people who fell in love with those Collins filters loved the fact that they were very flat across the pass band, very steep skirts, and they had a a critical ringing characteristic. In other words, it didn't give you a tubby sound. You gave it an impulse of energy, and the thing at the end of the impulse would be quiet, whereas other kinds of filters would ring for a while and give you a tubby sound. So people fell in love with the way sideband sounded through a mechanical filter made by Collins and maybe Caucasai. I bet you've run into situations, Mel, where people really didn't want to use anybody else's filter but the Collins mechanical filter in various applications. Is that true? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
K2KEY again. Oh, of course. My Collins written upstairs, Rich has. I have an original A4. I purchased with the one owner, was purchased originally by a person I knew, and there was his will that I bought it from him in the States, so I've got the original A4, everything original except for maybe a couple of, I don't know, I may have replaced three tubes over the years, but still going strong with the three original filters in it. And of course I got a Collins 30, the KWS1, got a Collins filter in it, and mechanical filters, and on and on and on, and the F-line. But there was nothing like it, and to this day, I still say it holds its own. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you a couple of words about Collins.
Yeah, when it comes back, also mention the word digital signal processing and software-defined radios. Have any of the digital signal processing filter-like functions come even close to the Collins mechanical filter? Or do you think Collins is still on the top of the mountain, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Mel. Wait for the beeps. And you could use a little bit more rhodium.
Okay, turn it up a little bit. Well, anyway, you see, with mechanical filters, maybe it's my old ears, my ears gone by, my old ears, but I like the sound, the natural sound of the mechanical filter. I have DSP. I have a number of very sophisticated so-called new radios with DSPs and all kinds of things, and you name it. I got a number of DSP DAPs and gadgets, but when it's all said and done, give me back the old mechanical filter. Now, Collins, remember, all Collins mechanical filters, they never built anyone that were above 1 megahertz. All the mechanical filters were, I could say, mostly all 455 kilohertz type filters. They never went. They never made a real Collins, never made, nor ever looked into anything above 1 megahertz. The original Collins filter had three sections into it. Input inducer, input transducer, mechanically resonant filter section, and then an output transducer. That's the original design, first mechanical filters of Collins, and of course, they were expanded upon as time went by. But, to my ear, I'll take the, if I listen to a number of pieces of equipment set up all on the same frequency, listening to the same CW, I'll wind up choosing the one with mechanical filter I was best picked over.
Glenn recognized when we were over to you in a minute. That's interesting, Mel, that never above a megacycle. Now, there were a number of single sideband filters operating in the 8 megahertz region, and I was naively assuming that some of those were mechanical filters. I think you're about to tell me that all of the 8 megacycle type single sideband filters, maybe they were the so-called ceramic filters, but not necessarily Collins mechanical filters. Is that true, Mel?
I do exchange comment with
K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel.
No, did I step on somebody or something? I thought you turned it to me, Dick.
Yes, I did turn it to you. Right now, it's going to be you, Glenn, and Wesley in that order. You got it, Mel.
Okay, as I said, what you're talking about most likely was the SAW type filter, the SAW type filter design, Dick. They were, I could say, in the region of 8 megahertz and all, but Collins, no, never went above a megahertz. Collins company, by the time they started looking into, well, DSP and all those things, Collins company was long gone, over.
Okay, so the 8 meg crystals were, 8 meg filters were SAW filters. SAW stands for surface acoustic wave. If you've got a piezoelectric material, in other words, mechanical, put a voltage on it and it mechanically spawns or vice versa. And if now, instead of having these slabs like a comb line that I described, which I think is the Collins mechanical filter below 1 megacycle, if instead you've got this slab of material and you've got a whole bunch of fingers, interdigital fingers that do the launching, and an interdigital set of fingers that do the reception, and in between there's a bunch of fingers that do actually all of the filtering. So a surface acoustic wave, and there's also something called a BAW, B-A-W, which is, I can't remember right now, it runs, bulk effect acoustic filtering. But the surface acoustic wave is another very sophisticated kind of filter, and some of those filters go higher than 1 gigahertz. In recent times. In the old days, they had great trouble getting beyond a couple of 100 megacycles. But you can buy SAW filters these days that go to 1 gigahertz. KC2QIQ. Go right ahead with your comment or question, Glenn. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. Everybody on the web tonight. It's interesting that, you know, talk about Collins filters, but while there, Ace is actually selling Collins branded filters, panicky filters, for, I think they're high-end radios. You could have gotten them, I believe, for the ST-1000 series. The other radios were actually, if you wanted to, aside from having the regular CSP, you could get the Collins mechanical filter inside. Whether that was actually Collins Rockwell, I'm not really sure, but I know it was definitely Collins branded, and the sticker would actually be on the outside of the box. Another very interesting mechanical filter by Drake, and an outside company called Sherwood. They made a very, very high quality filter as well. That kicked that one out there. They case for identification, too, correct?
Glenn, you are giving us nice, clean RF, nice, clean audio, but your audio is about 8 to 10 decibels too low. You need a lot more audio. Your mic gain is set low, or that particular microphone has changed its characteristic, Glenn. You might like to know that. But thank you on those Sherwood and other kinds of filters. There's a real art and science to making good, clean-sounding filters. When a filter is really doing what it's supposed to do, single sideband can sound at least as good as a telephone circuit, a modern-day, perfectly operating telephone circuit, and you never even know that the signal is coming through sideband. You may or may not know that the majority of the signals that you get through a wired telephone circuit really are single sideband signals. That's how they get that many signals on one piece of wire, so to speak. So with the proper kind of filtering, sideband can sound equally as high in fidelity as you can imagine. We amateurs who use heavily speech processed narrowband filters and our ham radio circuits, we live with single sideband that has a very characteristic sound that we learn, we teach our ear to tolerate it. But the average person hearing it for the first time says, gee, that's not very pleasant sounding audio. It's got a lot of punch to it, but I almost don't recognize that person, so to speak. But sideband doesn't have to be that way. Go ahead with your comment, Wes. N2XJN, K2LAW in the TechNet.
One of the first primary differences between the crystal filters and mechanical filters and the ceramic filters is that the first one uses the crystals. The second one uses steel and nickel iron alloys. And those are the common materials for the mechanical filter components. Nickel is sometimes used for the output, input and output couplings. So these resonators in the filter made from this material need to be machined precisely and adjust their resonance frequency before final assembly. And the third group is the ceramic filters. Now, as far as the ceramic filters, there is one company that is pretty much known for it. Cannot really recall that name. Oh, the mechanical filter.
Of
we're trying to at least describe the quality factor for this mechanical resonator. That's how the Q factor was born. Back to you.